It's time for America Outdoors Radio, the show that covers the outdoor scene across the U.S. of A. and the entire continent. Fishing, hunting, conservation, outdoor recreation, and great destinations, we cover it all every week. It's your country, your outdoors. Let's explore it together with your host, John Cruz.
Welcome to the show. We've got some great news to share with you today. The Outdoor Writers Association of America, a group made up of hundreds of professional outdoors media professionals, is holding their annual conference in virtual form this weekend. Part of that conference involves the annual Excellence in Craft Awards contest, where members submit their best work, which is judged, and if it's considered one of the three best in its category, it receives an Excellence in Craft Award. We entered five categories for what I thought were our best interviews from last year when it came to radio and podcasting, and we received four Excellence in Craft Awards. We're going to share those interviews with you today. One was a first place award winner in the outdoor gear and tech category for a conversation we had with Andy Wunsch, the president of the Duckworth Company. Another interview you'll hear is with Liz Thorntonson. We received a first place award in the outdoor fun and adventure category for the conversation we recorded with her about efforts to build a transcontinental rail trail for hikers, bicyclists, horseback riders, and other outdoors enthusiasts called the Great American Rail Trail. In the conservation category, we received a third place award for our interview with Bob Rees. He's with the Northwest Association of Steelheaders, and his organization is on a quest for 100K, a campaign meant to get back to returns of 100,000 spring Chinook up Oregon's Willamette River every year. Finally, if you're into big game hunting, I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation with outdoors writer Jeff Holmes, who tells the tale of drawing a quality bull elk tag and then trying to fill that tag during a very memorable hunt in Washington State's Blue Mountains last fall. This interview won a third place award in the hunting category. Put it all together, and I think you're going to find that great guests and interesting topics make for good radio. So settle in and enjoy as we share some of last year's best outdoors radio with you today. Let's start things off with an interview we aired right around Christmas last winter. The topic, a favored material for winter outdoors enthusiasts, wool, specifically merino wool, and even more specifically, Montana merino wool. We've got Andy Wunsch on the line. He is the president of the Duckworth Company. They are based in Montana, and they are all about wool clothing. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
So, Andy, why don't you tell us the brief story about Duckworth as a Montana wool company, because this is a little unusual.
It is unusual. So Duckworth was founded in 2015, actually on a ski lift. Between one of the founders was passionate about the wool clothing business, and the other founder passionate about the sheep ranching business. And they thought they could make a great wool garment. The ranch was, you know, at the time selling its wool, which we believe is some of the finest merino wool in the world, as a commodity, and agriculture as a price taker. And the concept is, how do you go beyond the gate and take the wool into a garment where it's more value add and spread the message to a broader audience? So Duckworth was created to take the wool from our ranch, which is down in Dillon, Montana, run by the Helly family. It's a fifth generation ranch. Take the wool, process it into fine yarn and fabric in the United States, and then all of our cut and sew is in the United States as well. So by creating these fine wool garments here in America, we take about 20,000 miles out of the supply chain and just adds to sustainability and reducing our carbon footprint.
Well, I love it. Now, I'm trying to go back into my wool history here. Isn't a lot of merino wool, doesn't it come from New Zealand?
It does. New Zealand is the largest, and then China is the second largest producer of merino wool. But the Northern Rockies has a very large agricultural group that's making some of the greatest merino wool we feel in the world.
So what is the difference between merino wool and the regular wool clothing that I wore, you know, 30, 40 years ago when I was in the military, or maybe when I was out trekking the hills with a heavy wool shirt?
Right. So merino wool is a very fine fiber. The old wool that you're used to is a very coarse fiber. And when you cut that up and spin it into yarn, you have lots of pointy ends that stick out. So merino wool is a much finer fiber, maybe in the 19 to 21, what we call microns. So it's very, very fine. And what makes Montana merino, especially the merino wool that we're raising on the Helly Ranch, is Dillon, Montana is at 5,000 feet elevation, where the sheep spend their winters. In the summertime, we had them up on the sheep trail up into the gravelies at 9,500 feet. And temperatures range from the 90s in the summertime to minus 20 in the wintertime. And the sheep wear the same wool coat year-round.
Right.
So wool is great at regulating temperature. Merino wool, especially our wool, has what's called a very long staple. So it's a very durable fiber. On a flex testing machine, a merino wool fiber takes about 20,000 bends to break, whereas a cotton fiber breaks in about 3,000 bends. Our wool is also dries very quickly. It has a high curvature and a high crimp, which gives it a lot of loft. So it makes it really cozy next to skin, dries fast. And then one of the key benefits of merino wool is its antimicrobial properties. It dries so fast that bacteria can't stick to it. So therefore, you can wear merino wool clothing next to skin for multiple days in a row without having to wash. So you can own less clothing and wash it less.
You know, that's really interesting to say that. Again, going way back in the day, we're talking like 30, 40 years ago, the wool clothing I wore back then, two things came to mind, especially when I was in the military. I was in the infantry, so we sweated a lot, and it stunk. It got to stink pretty good. Number two, it itched, and merino wool, I've noticed, doesn't itch, does it?
It does not. The fibers are so fine, and the way it's spun into a fine yarn, you can wear a very thin layer next to skin that doesn't itch, won't collect bacteria, doesn't stink, and really, you can wear wool year-round. We have people on the ranch who this week, it's probably in the 20s up there. We have people down in Arizona that wear a short-sleeve merino shirt to run in 90-degree temperatures.
Well, I want to talk about that because, again, talk about lightweight fabric that's wool, which kind of blows my mind here. You've got something called vapor wool that is meant for warm temperatures and exercising and everything else. Tell our listeners about vapor wool. I had never heard of it before.
Absolutely. So vapor wool is a proprietary technology for ductwork. And what we've done is created a blend of merino wool and a natural substance called modal and a little bit of poly and nylon in there. So you have a very lightweight fabric designed to be worn next to skin. And the term vapor comes from the actual functionality of the fabric, that as your body generates heat, the wool in the fabric disperses it. Wool is great at moving moisture away from the body and then evaporating it quickly. So for like on the ranch specifically, they'll wear a vapor short sleeve as their base layer next to skin all summer long, and then in the fall switch to long sleeves and put heavier and heavier layers over the top of it. But we also have Nordic skiers, cross-country runners, steelhead fishermen, any activity where you stop and go. So you're working, building up a sweat, like imagine being on a hunt, leaving your truck, the first thing you do is go uphill, you're generating lots of moisture, lots of heat, and then you stop where it can be very cold. So what vapor does is moves the moisture away from your skin, allows you to regulate your temperature, and then when you do stops, still stay very warm.
Andy, this is absolutely fascinating. Never knew there was so much science behind wool. I will never look at a sheep the same way again, I'll tell you what, after this conversation. You know, we've worked our way through the holiday season at this point. I've got to ask, you know, of all the products that you sell for men, for women, for the outdoors, what are the two most popular items?
Our two most popular ones in our Vapor series, which we've been talking about, and we make a pair of men's boxer shorts called the Vapor Brief. And a wool boxer is lightweight, dries fast. They don't need washing very often. So if I travel on a 10 or 12-day trip, I'll probably bring two pairs of boxers with me. So you can get by with much less clothing. And the Vapor Brief is by far one of our biggest unit sellers. The other one for both men and women is our Powder series. We make a powder hoodie sweatshirt for men and a powder high neck for women. And this is the thicker fabric of merino wool and acrylic. And it's just to put on, cozy down. You can wear it drinking coffee by the fire. You can wear it sitting on top of a ridge while you're glassing and scouting for animals. A dear friend of mine is a fishing guide who spends 4 months in Chile down in South America. And he brings two powder hoodies with him to wear, you know, at waders as his bottom layer and a powder hoodie as his upper layer for rain, snow. Feature I did not mention, but merino wool is also naturally water repellent. So you get stuck in a light rainstorm, light snowstorm, you don't have to put on that outer shell. The merino will just move the moisture away. So both the Vapor series in the brief or the t-shirt, or the Powder series in the hoodie or the high neck.
Okay. And last question for you. The holidays are over, but if folks go to duckworthco.com, are they going to find any after Christmas specials?
There are some after Christmas specials, and we're at duckworthco.com, and we have some closeouts on the site of some discontinued things, but also remind everyone too that winter is just beginning. Here in Montana or out where you are, there's still lots of cold weather ahead of us. So lots of great wool products to keep you insulated. I encourage you to come to our website and take a look. Everything from next to skin, socks, sweaters, jackets, and hats. I think we have something for everybody.
That's duckworthco.com, duckworthco.com. It's the Montana Wool Company. And as you heard, it's a very innovative wool clothing company as well. We've been telling you about Sportsman's Cove Lodge in Southeast Alaska for a while now, and there's a reason. They are the only Alaska lodge we talk about in this show. It's because they're truly Alaska's best lodge. The adventure starts with a float plane ride from Ketchikan, after which you'll get the chance to experience some of the best hospitality, food, and wonderful people you'll ever meet. Wildlife is abundant, from bears and deer to eagles and whales, and let's not forget the reason you're here, the fishing. Halibut, salmon, lingcod, rockfish, true cod, and more. It's all waiting for you in abundance at Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Book your trip today at alaskasbestlodge.com. That's alaskasbestlodge.com for Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Welcome back. I'm John Cruz. We're checking in with Bob Reese. He is with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders, and they've got quite a quest going on in the Willamette River in Oregon. It's called the Quest for 100K, getting 100,000 spring Chinook back to the Willamette Basin each and every year. Bob, welcome to the show.
John, thanks for having me today.
Bob, this seems like a very tough thing to do, but I guess before we talk about getting to 100,000 spring Chinook, we should talk about where we're at now and what this run looked like on a historic basis.
Yeah, great question, John. You know, prior to European settlement, the Willamette River, Willamette Valley, it's got several large tributaries in the upper and lower basin. We used to see runs of 300,000 all wild ring Chinook prior to the development of the basin. So we understand, you know, we'll never get to that number again, but we can certainly do better than what we're doing now. Currently, the return for Willamette River spring Chinook this year is forecasted to be 40,000 fish, of which about 75 to 80% of them will be hatchery origin.
Okay, well, we know where we're at. We know what the goalpost is, 100,000. And I understand that the Association of Northwest Steelheaders has identified four things or four ways to get to this 100,000 spring Chinook return. And one of them is already working. I've been hearing some great news about sea lions. And I know that one thing that you think is really important is stopping those sea lions from decimating runs at bottlenecks on the river, like below Willamette Falls.
That's right. And I failed to mention that we have historically actually had runs of 100,000 spring Chinook before back to the system about 20 years ago. We had 2 years, in fact, where we did see 100,000 fish return to the mouth of the Columbia River. 1 year, we had 130,000 fish actually pass are just under 100,000 fish past Willamette Falls. So it is possible, which, you know, gives us something to shoot for. All the conditions have to come together the right way. But on those sea lions, yes, the sea hunters have a seat on the Pinniped Fishery Task Force there that promoted the Section 120 permit that allows us to currently take sea lions from the reach, the mouth of the Clackamas River to Willamette Falls. To date, there's been about 18 California sea lions removed from that short reach of the river where most of the predation was taking place. And we've already seen incredible results with wild winter steelhead, nearly double the adult passage of wild winter steelhead to the upper basin that we've seen in the previous 2 years. So it is working. That is leg number one of the campaign. You're right.
And that's wonderful. And I hope there's some folks with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and with the National Marine Fisheries Service that are listening to this with an eye towards our southern killer whale populations in Puget Sound. So going to step number two, upstream passage, how do we increase Chinook populations with better upstream passage?
Exactly. There's 13 major dam systems on the Upper Willamette Basin, and most of us would be surprised to learn in this day and age that there might be a couple, but certainly the vast majority of them do not have fish passages in the Upper Basin. And of course, if you don't have a method for getting juveniles that are born in the Upper Basin past the dams and downstream to their saltwater life cycle, why would you bother with passage in the first place? So we need both collection facilities for juveniles that utilize the incredible amount of habitat that exists above those dams. Historically, upwards of 70% of the steelhead and salmon production took place above those dams. That's why they have mitigation measures in place, why we have hatcheries to replace the historic loss of those wild production areas that the Corps of Engineers cut off when they put those facilities in place. And then, of course, getting passage for the adults to utilize. There's over 400 miles of high-quality habitat, spawning and rearing habitat above those dams that those fish currently don't have access to.
And I think it's important to note, we're not talking about breaching dams here. We're just talking about installing fish ladders or other means to get those adult salmon past the dams. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. And it was outlined in the 2008 biological opinion that was drafted over a decade ago that if we do provide passage, if the Corps of Engineers provides passage to those facilities, that we will have an incredible rebound of wild populations to the basin.
Well, when it comes to these dams, you know, getting the adults up there is important. You already touched on this. We have to get the smolts downstream as well. And the flows, whether it's from the Columbia River dams or the Willamette River dams, how much water is going over when these fish are migrating? That's a big deal in terms of their survival, isn't it?
It absolutely is, yes. And that conversation is also taking place right now about how much water to release during out-migration, increasing the diversity of life histories in the basin. You know, everybody knows that certain flooding events or drought events happen during certain times of the year. Over time, these fish have had a wide variation in when they migrated to the ocean, when they came back as adults. We've constrained those life histories in the basins, mostly because of the increase in hatchery production. We release all the smolts at the same time. We grow them all to the same size before release. All this homogenization of hatchery fish life histories has really helped, you know, decimate the diversity we had in the basin, and therefore causing us all to basically put all our eggs in one basket, and why we've also suffered dismal returns in the basin over time.
Very interesting observation. The last pillar of this campaign is implementing wild broodstock programs on the Willamette system. So the state of Oregon is actually, I think, far ahead of everybody else in the greater Northwest when it comes to broodstock programs. But I think we better take a step back, explain what a broodstock program is, and then talk about how you would like to see this enacted on the Willamette River to benefit salmon.
Yeah, thanks, John, for teeing that up. We've seen the successful results of wild broodstock programs on the Oregon coast, in particular with winter steelhead. Sport anglers select wild winter steelhead on the Wilson and the Stuka Rivers, and they place them in holding pens before they're taken to the hatchery. And then during the right spawning time, those fish are spawned, all wild adults, and their offspring are reared in the hatchery. Their fins are clipped, and they're released back into the wild to head to the sea and come back. And, you know, what we're seeing is with those broodstock fish is we're seeing a nice distribution of run timing. We're seeing fish that are larger and more robust in size. They're more aggressive. They bite better because basically we're breeding biting fish since anglers are harvesting them. And probably the most important aspect of broodstock programs is that we're seeing returns somewhere between 2 and 6% when traditional hatchery returns yield less than 1% return rates. For example, spring Chinook that are forecast to come back this year, we released 5.5 million spring Chinook smolts into the upper basin. Yet last year, we only saw a return of 37,800 adults. That's less than one half of 1% return rate. So basically, you put out a higher quality hatchery product based on wild broodstocks that's collected and raised in the hatcheries, you start yielding a 2% minimum return rate on those smolts. And we could have 100,000 spring Chinook if we were able to convert to wild broodstock tomorrow. We just don't have that capability because the wild runs have been decimated so bad in the upper basin that we can't legally utilize those wild fish for hatchery production. There's just not enough of them to sustain themselves in the wild to do that just yet.
It's the quest for 100K, getting 100,000 spring Chinook back to the Willamette Basin each and every year. You just heard the four pillars of this campaign. And I don't know about you folks, but I think this is doable if this group and others gets the help they need. The group, again, is the Association of Northwest Steelheaders. Find them on Facebook. They have chapters throughout the Northwest. And if you want to support this campaign, well, go to a meeting, get involved, and find out more. Bob, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me, John. I just want to throw out, too, that we have a June 22nd fundraiser that helps fund this campaign, the Willamette Salmon Quest. We'd love to have people participate in that June 22nd fundraiser to help make this campaign a reality.
Sounds great. And again, folks, find out more on Facebook at the Association of Northwest Steelheaders page.
Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is the voice for your public lands, waters, and wildlife. From the Canadian Yukon to the Florida Everglades, we're stepping up to conserve North America's public lands, defend our hunting and fishing traditions, and expand access to the outdoors. Find out how you can get involved at backcountryhunters.org.
Are you looking to reel in the marketing opportunity of a lifetime? Then set the hook, because we've got it right here for you. America Outdoors Radio has sponsorships available, and we offer affordable platforms to reach thousands of listeners interested in fishing, hunting, and the outdoors. Find out more by contacting John Cruz through his website at AmericaOutdoorsRadio.com.
You're back with Outdoors Radio. I'm John Cruz. It's story time. We are going to tell you a hunting story. And the narrator of this story is Jeff Holmes. He is an outdoors writer. He's based in Pasco, Washington. Jeff, it's great to have you on the air.
Great to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, I want to talk about that beautiful 6x6 bull elk you tagged out on the Blue Mountains. I saw that on Facebook right after you posted it, reached out to you immediately. It's like, I've got to share your story on the air. We'll call it a hunt in three acts. We'll start at the very beginning in terms of the work that went into getting the tag for this hunt. Then we'll go to the hunt itself, and then we'll talk about the final day. So let's start off with Act 1, getting the tag for this elk and all the pre-hunt preparation you did.
Sure. But the tag I got was not an easy tag to get, and I got kind of lucky drawing it. I only had 13 points in Washington's preference system. Only one muzzleloader, any bull tag, is given out in the very large unit that I hunted in, which is the Lick Creek unit in the Blue Mountains. You know, there aren't a lot of big bull tags in the Blues, but Lick Creek has, I think, the fewest that are given out, even though it's a giant chunk of property. You know, I've been applying and applying and applying, even though I'm really not a diehard elk hunter. I mean, I elk hunt, but it's not a family tradition for me. Like you, John, I'm way more of a bird hunter. In fact, my friends during the hunt, I think, were kind of frustrated or at least amused that I was more fixated on blue grouse at times than on elk hunting. I'm also a pretty hardcore deer hunter, but, you know, this is the first time I've had a really primo elk tag. So I took it pretty seriously. Had a couple of setbacks. First one was that when I drew the tag, and what we find out about our special hunts in Washington in June, I think a lot of states find out earlier, I was not in great shape. That I am at the moment either, but I was in shape that was not consistent with walking around for days and days and hauling out, 400 pounds of meat.
Right.
So I went on a diet as soon as I drew that tag from WDFW, and that went well. I ended up dropping like 47 pounds before season.
Nice.
But I broke my ribs.
No. No.
Before season, which made some of my training more difficult. So my hunt ended up being kind of a crash course fitness, kind of like a double day football in high school. But it ended up working out pretty well. I got up in the mountains and scouted a few times for sure. I'd already stomped all over that game management unit, bluegrass hunting from the time I was 11 till I'm 43 now, so quite a while. So I already had an idea of the lay of the land, but I'd never been chasing elk up there before. I usually do that in the thick wolf-infested forest of northeast Washington. So this was different. There aren't, as yet, I'm sure they walk in there, but there isn't a wolf pack in Lick Creek that I know of, so... It ended up being a pretty special hunt where just the elk weren't pressured a whole lot. And some of the biggest challenges I faced were my own fitness and the fact that they were burning slash piles, incredible numbers of slash piles with flames licking as high as 50 feet tall.
Oh, my gosh.
And we actually saw that affect the elk behavior.
Well, before we get into the hunt itself, I want to talk about something else. You had mentioned before we went on the air that the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, they kind of helped you out with this hunt. I mean, clearly they helped you out in terms of you were lucky enough to draw the tag. But beyond that, what did our state wildlife agency do for you?
Yeah, I think WDFW, they're not perfect, and they definitely, I've got my criticisms, as we all do, but knowing a lot of folks in the department and having briefly worked for them, actually at one point in the director's office, I've got some compassion for them, and I think they do a lot right that we don't hear about. In 1989, when they did their post-hunt surveys of the Blue Mountains elk herds, the mature bull-to-cow ratio was down to something like 2 to 4. Mature bulls per 100 cows across all of what are now the spike-only GMUs.
Right, that's awful.
That's as bad as I think it gets. So they instituted that spike-only regulation, which engendered a lot of bad blood just because of the lack of understanding of what they were doing. And DFW has a lot of constraints and aren't always great at explaining to the public why they're making tough decisions. And I think a lot of rumors erupt from that. And I know this because I wrote, my editor, Northwest Sportsman Magazine, Andy Walgamott, several years ago asked me to write kind of a comprehensive elk hunting piece about the blues. So I researched the heck out of it with every bio I could talk to. And pretty amazing what's happened there, the transformation in the structure of the elk herd. Now at the end of hunting seasons, when they do their post-hunt surveys, there's 18 to 24 mature bulls per 100 cows left in the blues.
Wow.
That's amazing, right? Frustrates some people.
That is quite the comeback. All right, let's get into Act 2, the hunt itself. You've already described this sort of scenery with slash burns burning everywhere.
Yeah.
What else was going on in the Blue Mountains when you went hunting there at the end of September?
Well, I got super lucky and got really cold weather. I live in Tri-Cities. It's probably the warmest place here in the Northwest, and pretty worried about being out there and not having a lot of support and shooting an animal far from the road and having game wastage. So I was going to limit my hunting to pretty close to the road, but a couple of really awesome things happened. First, got a major cold snap. All the mountains in the west got hammered. I know like the eastern front of the Rockies in places got 4 feet of snow. We didn't get 4 feet of snow, but we had, 2 to 4, maybe 5 inches across most of where I was hunting, most of the time that I was hunting. That was awesome. And then the second really important thing that happened for me is I had a couple of friends step up to come with me on the hunt. I was literally the only tag holder. Most of my friends are fishing guides, or they're archery hunters, or they're muzzleloaders like me. And they were either on hunts, going on hunts, or taking people fishing. So I was pretty worried I was going to be alone. But Bryce Doherty, Boardman, Oregon, O'Doherty Outfitters, who's a pretty well-known fishing guide and a heck of a guy, he loves to elk hunt. He's probably just as good a hunter as he is a fisherman, and he's a great fisherman. But he tells me he doesn't ever want to guide hunting because he doesn't want to take all the fun out of it because he's so passionate about it. And I really found that to be true. A friend of mine, too, I hadn't seen since grade school, came up as well. So he and I and Bryce were kind of a team.
Well, we've got about 1.5 minutes left. Tell me about the connection with this huge 6x6 bull.
Sure. So day 5 of hiking in the mountains, day 4 of season, and night 3 we had glassed some really giant bulls, some finger ridges that had moved out of heavy timber to feed in some really lush grass on some WDFW property. And we decided, okay, let's stop hunting around those slash piles where we're seeing, diminishing numbers of elk, whereas we had seen them a couple days before they were lit. And let's go down an elevation and hunt these finger ridges. So Bryce and I got out there in the dark and started walking down a ridge, listening for bugles. He's a master bugler. You know, after a while, we heard some bugles start to erupt in deep canyons all around us.
Wow.
And, I mean, you know, the bulls that we'd seen the night before, it was pretty dark, but they were, you know, if you know anything about the Blue Mountains elk herd, we've got 400-inch elk here. And I'm not going to say we saw 400-inch elk, but we saw giant elk, like the kind that you would see in Yellowstone where the wolves nicked them.
Right.
So we were pretty excited. We had an elk bugle really close to us, probably quarter mile, slightly more. So we dropped down into some timber, played the wind, made a setup where, we had the bull coming. And he was bugling his heart out, roaring at us. We were just cow calling. Bryce was doing the calling at that point. I snuck down, got in position behind a small tree, kind of trying to intercept where the bull was going to pop out. Bryce was behind me about 80 yards calling in some dark timber. And when I saw that bull approaching, at first he was jogging, and then he was running to the point where he was almost at a full run.
Wow.
I watched him crash through some small ponderosa pines that were too thick to get his big antlers through. He ripped off a bunch of branches.
Oh, my gosh.
And he emerged broadside, quartering toward me at what seemed like incredibly close range. I once shot a bear at 12 yards that I called in. That's the closest thing I've ever shot other than birds. This guy was not much further out than that. I think we paced it off at about 18 yards afterwards. But he quartered to me. I fired, blew a 300 grain all brass, no lead, machined bullet right through his shoulder and out both lungs. He wheeled around, kicked up a bunch of dirt, ran about 60 yards, and laid down, which I thought was a pretty good sign.
Absolutely.
But not being a seasoned elk hunter, I just hunkered down and waited for Bryce. We waited about 20 minutes, walked up there, and he was stone dead and beautiful. Nice, big, mature 6x6, 370 pounds of meat to the butcher, beautiful sweat back. Main beams, not the biggest bull in the Blues by any means, but a big, nice, mature 6x6 with extraordinarily white, ivory-tipped antlers, because I think he spends a lot of time kind of in the open there on that WDFW property.
Incredible hunting story told in three acts by Jeff Holmes. And folks, I can guarantee you, you're going to be reading about this sooner than later. Is this going to be in Northwest Sportsman or somewhere else, Jeff?
It's definitely going to be somewhere, for sure. And, John, if you don't mind, can I just give a shout-out to a couple of people who helped me on the hunt? They're not sponsors or anything, but it really matters to me. First, I'd just like to give a plug for Randy Newberg's show. If you haven't seen Fresh Tracks, Randy Newberg's an all-public lands elk hunter, and I drew a lot of inspiration in my weight loss journey from Randy, watching all the hills that he was humping up and down. And I've never had nice binoculars either, so I blew some coin on Vortex, which I found to be a lot more affordable than other binoculars on the market,
right.
And they really made my hunt. They were huge. Finally, Beatles to Bones, which, you know, you've got a lot of listeners here in Tri-Cities, and I don't think a lot of people know this guy exists, but David Winden lives out in Badger Canyon here in Tri-Cities, and he has those cool beetles that, you know, eat the brains and the meat around your skulls to make European mounts, and he does it for really cheap. So I'd recommend looking him up.
All right. Beetles to Bones, that's the company there. And you heard the other shout-outs, too. We have got to go, Jeff, but congratulations on taking a beautiful bull elk and sharing the story with us here today.
Thanks for letting me talk about it.
Hunting and fishing are exercises in hope. Before you head into the woods, you hope to tag out on a deer you'll have to field dress. Before you make that first cast, you hope for a big fish to clean and fillet. When your hopes are realized, you'll need a sharp knife. Whether you sharpen that blade on a power sharpener in the shop or a manual sharpener in the field, WorkSharp has the tool for you. Look for WorkSharp products in sporting goods stores near you or online at WorkSharpTools.com.
The Dalzen, Oregon is your base camp for fishing fun. Reel in big salmon, tangle with steelhead, bass, and walleye, or wrestle a monster sturgeon to the boat. After the day is done, you'll find a variety of lodging options around town. Need to resupply? We've got you covered with sporting goods stores plus great dining, breweries, wineries, and can't-miss attractions like the Gorge Discovery Center. Plan your fishing getaway today at explorethedalles.com. That's explorethedalles.com.
Investment advisory services offered through Sound Income Strategies, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisory firm.
During difficult times, it's important not to be frozen by fear or complacency, thinking that Congress, the Fed, or your current financial planner will fix the impact of the pandemic on your retirement savings. The bottom line is, no one else is going to care about your retirement the way you do. There is another more conservative way to plan for income without all the risk, using interest and dividends. Call 888-888-4176 now to learn how the Retirement Income Store can help during these uncertain times. 888-888-4176. We'll send you our Retirement Income Kit with five educational tools, including David Scranton's best-selling book, 888-888-4176. The Retirement Income Store. Where retirees go for income. Call 888-888-4176 now.
Immerse yourself in a complete Alaska wilderness experience through Sportsman's Cove Lodge. Up to six of you will spend a week in a beautiful waterfront log home in a secluded cove. Every day is a new adventure. Go on a guided fishing trip or haul in a bounty of shrimp and crab. Visit a Native American village where totem poles are carved. Go on a whale or bear watching trip and return back to your very own place at the end of the day. Find out more about the Alaska Wilderness Experience at alaskasbestlodge.com. That's alaskasbestlodge.com.
We're broadcasting from the train depot in Clee Ellum, Washington. An exciting, very exciting announcement has been made about a new rail trail that's stretching from Washington State to Washington, D.C. It's called the Great American Rail Trail. And with us here to tell you more about it is Liz Thorstenson. She's the Vice President of Trail Development for the Rails to Trails Conservancy. Liz, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, John. I'm happy to be here.
The timing of this announcement has to do with something that happened 150 years ago.
It absolutely does. The Golden Spike happened 150 years ago. And because this is a rail trail, it just couldn't be better timing that we're celebrating this day at this moment.
And to remind all of you, going back to U.S. history, that Golden Spike and Promontory was what connected America in terms of our railroads and all the immigration and all the commerce that went from east to west and west to east and really built up our nation into what it is today. That happened in 1869, but here we are in 2019. A lot of those railroads have been abandoned. A fair amount of them have been converted already to rail trails that are multi-use trails for bikers, for horseback riders, for hikers. And now your vision is to connect it all together to make it a transcontinental rail trail. Tell me more about exactly how many miles are we talking here?
We're talking 3,700 miles across the country from Washington, D.C. to Washington State.
Wow. People hear this and they're thinking, this is going to be hard to do. But the fact of the matter is that you've got a good portion of this that already exists today.
Absolutely. There's already over 50% of this trail complete, and that's why we're elevating this moment to say we really think that the next 50% is within sight, and we're gathering all of our state partners and hundreds of local partners from across the country to commence this work and finish this trail.
So 1,900 miles of rail trails already exist. And like we said, folks, this isn't just for people to walk on, bicycle on, or ride a horse on. You know, a lot of these rail lines, they were built along streams because that was a natural route for them to go to. So if you're an angler, you might be interested in going on some of these. If you're a wildlife watcher, a lot of these rail trails go through some land that is really undisturbed. So bring your binoculars, bring your camera. There's a lot to do on these trails. And in some places, I understand there's even parks alongside where you can camp.
Absolutely. This trail really demonstrates the tremendous geography and diversity of our country. You can see every landscape along this route. If you want to camp, there are definitely places, depending on the state you're in, where you can find those locations along open sections. For example, I know near where I live in Washington, D.C., the CNO Canal Trail, there are absolutely camping spots, and I've been so happy to meet people this week in Washington State who have told me they've visited there and they've camped along the CNO to do their ride.
Well, let's work our way from west to east through the greater Northwest. And let's start off with Washington State, because there's a great existing rail system that's already here with just a few bridges, literally, that need to be gapped.
Absolutely. So the main gem that we're celebrating, and we're at this spot today in Cle Elum, Washington, is to celebrate the Palouse to Cascades State Park Trail. This is the main spine that really makes the Great American Rail Trail possible in Washington State. And it's one of the longest rail trails in the country. So we're so thrilled that this can be the spine for the Washington Network.
This really goes from the Cascade Mountains east into the Palouse country, and it connects to Idaho. Now, Idaho, also, it may be a small part of the state that has this rail trail that's part of the Great American Rail Trail, but it's got one of the best parts, especially the route of the Hiawatha that goes through here.
Absolutely. You've got the route of the Hiawatha. You've got the Coeur d'Alene. These are just iconic rail trails that connect you into Idaho.
And folks, if you've never done the route of the Hiawatha before along the border of Idaho and Montana, you are missing out. It is one of the most spectacular, family-friendly rail trail bicycle riding experiences you'll ever enjoy. You'll cross trestles, you'll go through tunnels. It is a true adventure you're going to love. Now, moving from Idaho into Montana, this is where we start having some real gaps where we don't have existing rail trails. What are the plans to get you from Montana into Wyoming?
So there's about 20% of the Great American Rail Trail complete in Montana, which, as you know, would leave 80% to complete. But there are lots of great connection opportunities. We've had excellent meetings with Montana leaders, and there's great systems like the Headwaters Trail System in and around Three Forks, which is where we kicked off our launch today over there. So there are great assets, lots of communities that already connect to the outdoors. It's just a matter of kind of bringing the pieces together.
And I think you're going to find you're going to get a lot of support from the state of Montana and their outdoor recreation arm as well, because they do see the vision here. Of that, knowing those people, I have no doubt that's going to happen. Another place that's all about the outdoors is the state of Wyoming. But again, there's very little existing rail trail that's in the Cowboy State.
Absolutely. There's a lot of work to do in Wyoming. But again, we've had excellent partners there, excellent state leaders, wonderful meetings with them, and they're absolutely committed to making this vision a reality. One of the most exciting parts about the Wyoming sections is the entrance in and out of Yellowstone National Park. And so that's just such an exciting connection that we think will entice so many people to the trail. There's going to be other opportunities for rural economic development in the central part of the state as well. So lots to do, but lots of great opportunity to have lots of other benefits that align with the state's priorities. So we're excited about that.
And I think it's important to note you touched on something there, whether it's Wyoming or Montana that have to build these rail trails, or whether it's Washington and Idaho that already have them. There is a real economic benefit to these existing trails. And once you join them together, just like the Pacific Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail, you're going to have people that are going to be through bikers, through hikers, that are going to want to do an epic adventure like this. And they all have money that they're contributing to the local economy with.
Absolutely. We've cataloged lots of studies along the entire route across the country. So we're gathering those numbers. We know that bicycle tourism and walking tourism bring in lots of those external local economic development dollars that are so important to so many of these rural communities that have had shifts in their industry and are looking to diversify into other types of opportunities for their residents, other types of jobs. We also know that these kinds of assets attract new residents to want to live in these places and attract new employers. So whether you're in more of a mid-sized community or small town community, we know that there's this benefit if it's done really intentionally and collectively.
Let's talk about helping the Great American Rail Trail come to fruition. What can our listeners do to help out?
What we're trying to do right now is gather a million different people's voices together to pledge your support for the Great American Rail Trail. It's just a matter of signing up your name and email on greatamericanrailtrail.org. Put your voice in and let the country know that you support the vision of completing the Great American Rail Trail.
This is a way people can voice their support. I know you're going to need some money for this as well. Now, I know a lot of it's going to come from grants at both the federal and the state level, but at a certain point, you're going to need the users to step up and contribute too. Is there a mechanism for them to do this?
Absolutely. We most want people's voices and showing their support that this is something that they want, this gift to the country. But it takes a lot of work across our organization and lots of partner organizations to make this work happen. So those donations make a huge difference in enabling us to do our job as well.
Okay, so whether you want to donate or whether you just want to find out more, the website is the same. It's greatamericanrailtrail.org, greatamericanrailtrail.org. The Rails to Trails Conservancy is spearheading this effort, but it's going to have great benefit to all of you who love to hike, who love to bike, who love to ride a horse, or just enjoy nature along those wonderful rail trails that we have across America. Again, 3,700 miles. That's the vision from Washington State to Washington, D.C. GreatAmericanRailTrail.org is the website to go to. Liz, thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. It was a pleasure to join you.
I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of America Outdoors Radio, featuring four award-winning interviews from the Outdoor Writer Association of America's Excellence in Craft Contest for 2019. Like I said at the beginning of the show, great guests and great topics make for great interviews and great radio, and I'm glad I was able to share it with you today. We've got to go, but if you didn't catch all of our show, you can always catch it as a podcast. One place to do so is on our Facebook page at America Outdoors Radio. And while you're there, don't forget to enter our fishing giveaway. If you want to enter, you still have until June 30th. All you have to do is catch a fish, take a picture of it, go to the post thread on our America Outdoors Radio Facebook page where we have this contest, and post it there. Once you post that picture, you are entered for a chance to win a $400 ultra light float tube from Wilderness Light, or tackle packages from Christensen's Lakeshore Tackle, from Max Lure, and from TTI Blakemore. We'll announce the four winners, who will be randomly drawn on July 1st. We are out of time. I do hope you are blessed in the week ahead, and I do hope you make it a point to spend some time outside. After all, it is your country, and you're outdoors, so get out there and enjoy it.